Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Caged In podcast, as ever brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, Petros Patsilivas. What are we doing this week, guys? Well, we're still rolling on with Cageuary, and we are here to talk to James M. McLeod from the Glasgow Film Festival all about his top five Nicolas Cage films. Right, if you're unaware of James's significance to Nicolas Cage, he did, for my money, one of the greatest things and kind of threads revolving around Nicolas Cage, which was if you posted a film, any film, James would reply with which would be the perfect Nicolas Cage film to double bill, a partner film for that. I'm joined here today with James. How are you, James?
Hi. Yeah, I'm doing well. I'm glad I'm here to talk about Nicolas Cage. It is my job right now to be talking about Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I always feel like. I'm like for a certain part of the week, it is my job to talk about Nicolas Cage or the extended Coppola family. And at this very moment, it's talking about Nicolas Cage.
It's not bad. It's a good crew. It's a good crew to be in with.
So let me first, ask you about the Glasgow Film Festival. There's so many film festivals out there, right? I kind of look through the calendar, and it's like, since kind of really diving into this podcast and looking at stuff of like where films are going to crop up, and especially keeping an eye on Nicolas Cage films. Where are they premiering? Where are the Coppola films going to be popping up and stuff like that? Is there a chance for me to see them before the general public? I've noticed there's the calendar year is just like, oh, there's a film festival here, there's a film festival there.
Oh yeah.
What is it for you that kind of like makes Glasgow kind of stand out in a way?
I mean, one of the big things with Glasgow is just it being in Glasgow, the sort of culture we have there. And I mean, especially around the Glasgow Film Theatre, which is Glasgow Film Festival's home and always has been, and just like the programming team there. And even just, I feel like we're positioned in the year, such a great way to get a sort of head start on all like the great indie films of the year. And I mean, we're like the second biggest festival in the UK now. And yeah, just brings so many people to Scotland, and with Fright Fest as well, it's a mixture of sort of genre fest and just worldwide cinema, pretty much. Nice. And in my own personal experience, has an important Cage connection for me, because one of my main things that got me involved with Cage at all was the Glasgow Film Festival.
Amazing.
The 2009 screening of Werner Herzog's Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans. Standing ovations, just like, rolling in the aisles. And genuinely, it was electric. And that's like the thing, is getting those electric screenings, seeing a film for the first time. People, you don't always know what you're getting into. And I mean, that film, I definitely did not know what I was getting into. And it just blew everyone away. And that's like the experience you're always looking for at Glasgow Film Festival. I mean, any film festival you want that, but I've had that at Glasgow several times. So yeah,
Well, Glasgow has this kind of connection with Cage in the way that there was the Cagerama Festival. Are you aware of that? That kind of like,
There was the CCA who we like often sometimes with Glasgow Film Festival do like screenings there and sometimes do like our industry program, sometimes events are there and stuff. I think that was with the Matchbox Cine Club.
Sure.
Who also did like a Keanu Reeves series as well. That's the thing is that like Glasgow, there's clearly like a longing for just cool film culture stuff to happen. I mean, like we're sort of doing that this year with this Under the Skin screening, which is going to be having like a live symphony orchestra playing the score and stuff like that. And it's, you know, trying to make unique experiences out of film. Because like already seeing something in the cinema is the way to see it. And when you're seeing it with a crowd and everyone's just getting electrified by what they're seeing, it's magic.
And a bit Under the Skin is a film that people of Glasgow kind of like, there's that Leonardo DiCaprio meme aspect of it where people are like, I know that street. Like,
you feel like a genuine pride as Scarlett Johansson picks off the young men of our city. We're just like, oh, you've done it, lads. She walked past, you know, Buchanan Galleries. I've been in there. I'm just like her.
I've seen a transit van on that street. It could have been her.
There's so many transit vans in Glasgow. It's basically a tourist attraction at this point. Just the Under the Skin experience is alive in Glasgow at all times of the year.
Amazing. Yeah, hopefully there's an installation which is a kind of black, goopy room.
yeah, just sink in here.
amazing. So apart from Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans, has there been any other Nicolas Cage films that have played Glasgow Film Festival in its run?
Oh, well, actually, I wish I knew more off the top of my head, but I know a few years ago we did this screening of Wild at Heart, which I believe was in a church. I would need to look up exactly what this is, but this is one of our like specials or screenings. Wow. And I mean, one of our like usual photographers, Ingrid Moore, the photo she has of just the Wild at Heart title card and like a church. It's beautiful. That's like somewhere on our Instagram. And it's just, that's an elemental like movie image right there.
It feels somewhat blasphemous showing that film in that location. And I love it.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's putrid, but profound, you know, it's everything.
Yeah. It's Wizard of Oz for a new generation, right? That film. It's got so many connections to that movie. So it's got a purity to it, and it's also got what Nicolas Cage like stabbing a guy in like his opening scene, and
and
dancing to speed metal. Do you know what I mean? That's what you want in a church. Anytime I've ever like gone to a gig that happens to be in a church, and I always feel like always feel a bit naughty. Do you know what I mean? Having like a can of beer in the church and like, I shouldn't be doing this, or I shouldn't be seeing rock music in a church, but it's happening, baby.
Yes, it's a whole new world, you know?
So I really need to ask you, James, about this kind of work of majesty, which was this kind of...
Yes.
I don't know, almost like Rain Man-esque. Like,
that's my life. I walk around like that. It's just see things and Nicolas Cage tales come in my brain.
So how did you go about this? Were you like... Yeah, like take me through it. Like explain to the audience what you did and how you went about it.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, everywhere in life, you know, whatever you're doing, you've got to be aware of what your skills are. Work towards your skill set. And through 2020, pretty much, I just thought I'm close enough to finish Nicolas Cage's filmography. I always enjoy watching them. I'm going to do it. I've always been a massive fan and defender of him, appreciator of him as an actor and just person. And so I saw that as a skill, and doing marketing, social media, all that kind of stuff. It was just an excuse to talk about it. Like ultimately I was thinking, I have seen all these films. That to me is a resource. I've got them fresh in my mind. What can I use this for? And I can use this on an official platform because I have access to it, and the good people at Glasgow Film Festival have trusted me with it. And hopefully, you know, they're proud with the work it's done. And then to be fair, the unbearable weight of massive talent was coming. And since that's so tied to his whole career and lineage, I thought as well, like, this is a good way to draw attention to as many of them as I can, because I just wanted to recommend them until I didn't feel comfortable recommending them. Like, if I'm at the point where I'm telling you to watch USS Indianapolis because your favorite movie is Jaws, I wouldn't feel, that wouldn't be ethical on my part. So
yeah, whilst watching UNS Indianapolis Men of Courage, it got to a point and I was like, do you know what, I would rather be hearing about this from Quint in Jaws than watching this movie.
I would probably watch that scene on repeat for the length of USS Indianapolis before rewatching USS Indianapolis, which, no offense to anyone who worked on it, great actors, Nicolas Cage, I never fault him. You know, man does his job, and you can always see why he chooses things, regardless of how it turns out. I feel like, even if the choice is based on him buying dinosaur bones off Leonardo DiCaprio.
Amazing. So yeah, so how did you go about this? Obviously, you said you had the extensive knowledge of watching all of Cage's films. Yeah. Like, but as they kind of came in, so like I pulled one up now. So somebody, right. somebody, yes, Sven Rufus has said Brazil, and your answer was. Now the Humanity Bureau might sound like a bureaucratic hell space you're after. But the energetic style you'd really want is Raising Arizona. Yeah, we recommend you Deadfall, with an all-time sicko mode Cage performance of A World of Its Own, A Dark Dream. What kind of, can you take us through the kind of the four steps, the kind of logic behind that?
Well, yeah, I generally only wanted to recommend ones that I, you know, really thought were good films, but there were times where something seemed like a better fit. And there was just that part of my brain that, you know, had seen all the films and had them all in my head. I don't want anyone to sort of think, but what about blah, 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 that's a better fit. It's like, no, I know, but this is better. And in this case, I mean, a lot of time it was about feeling, if I'm honest, because I, to be honest, like when you love something, like say if you love Brazil, do you really think that your sort of second favorite movie would be a film that pretty much follows the structure and plot of Brazil, but is like less good? You know, it's no, like it's going to be something that kind of generates some of the same feeling. And weirdly, like Raising Arizona, it gets it because, you know, it's frenetic, stylish, it's so, I don't know, it's got that sort of cartoonish energy. I mean, both, like, Terry Gilliam has actual sort of cartoonist background, but the Coens certainly bring that. I mean, Nicolas Cage is basically Bugs Bunny in that movie. But the case of Deadfall, I was just like, there's something about the non-stop, sweaty sort of one-upsmanship of it that was like, you know what, maybe somebody who can appreciate a film where for no reason, you know, Robert De Niro bashes through a wall and says he's a plumber, maybe they'd like a movie where Nicolas Cage is, you know, screaming and has a fake nose on, you know,
He's screwed about coat hangers, you fucking hangers, man.
I don't know, it was a lot of it was just almost entering just a zen-like state and then reaching out to the titles through feeling.
Where Brazil has the icon that is Robert De Niro, Deadfall has the icon that is Angus Scrimp. Do you know what I mean?
Like, exactly. An important Scotsman, I believe, which I'll need to double check, but as you know, Scottish native, that's always very important. And yeah, it's got that thing where he doesn't just appear, but doesn't he have like a claw hand or something in that film?
Yeah.
And it's just like, again, yeah, it's just okay, this is not just a random crime movie, it's just got an element of weird to it, and it's got the added element of weird that there's a pseudo sequel despite, you know, a character no longer existing, returning, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And yeah, I think that was Nicolas Cage just kind of throwing his weight around in his straight to VOD era, kind of saying, I will do this film, but I'm playing a character that I played in 1993 for no reason.
And I'm doing it for my brother.
And I believe his brother is in that movie as well.
I think so, he killed, also, just to correct myself, I don't believe Angus Scrimm was born in Scotland. I tried to claim him. I tried to claim the tall man.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't even think Angus Scrimm is his name. Scrimm sounds like it could be a Scottish. I believe his name isn't even Angus Scrimm. It's kind of a
it won't be, but I just thought, I could imagine seeing him standing by a foggy loch. Like, I don't know, like, it made sense.
Yeah, I remember hearing a great story about Angus Scrimm, about when he passed. Loads of people in his kind of regular life didn't know about the Angus Scrimm part, about his kind of existence, and that he'd done these Phantasm movies. So obviously, like Don Coscarelli and like the cast of Phantasm all turned up to his funeral, and they were like all these straight-laced people, like, who are these kind of movie types kind of turning up to his funeral? It's like, like he's made a career for himself just saying, boy.
Oh, fantastic. He and that legacy stretches for it. I'm just gonna have to mention this very peculiar piece of movie trivia, just because it's another part of Angus Scrimm's legacy. That sound effect of boy from the end of the first Phantasm movie is used as a sound effect for magic in the Hong Kong film The Boxer's Omen. Have you seen The Boxer's Omen?
No.
Okay. The Boxer's Omen is one of the most just bananas films that exists. It's about, I believe it's about Taiwanese sort of magic and mythology, and it is like nothing you've ever seen. And there's one part where I believe somebody's bringing a alligator back to life through a ritual that involves worms and skulls. And the sound effect is literally the last bits of audio from the first Phantasm. It's a smashing glass and then Angus Scrimm going, boy! And it's just, what beautiful mind thought, right, we need a sound effect for a piece of magic in the Phantasm.
Amazing. Amazing. I recently had a discussion with my stepdad about like films that he enjoyed, and he said, you know, a film I really, really enjoy, and I did not expect, this is a guy who watches like war movies, and like his kind of benchmark for a film is like based on a true story. So it's got to be good. It's based on a true story. He said to me, I really like, it's a film I watched like years ago and I really love it. It's called Phantasm. Have you ever heard of it? I was like, have I? I was like, not only have I heard it, I've seen it, and I've seen all the sequels. I was like, I'm a Phantasm head. I'm a...
Wow.
Yeah, so, of course. So I think I've said to him, what, one night I'm gonna have to show him The Joys, which is the rest of the Phantasm series. So before we get into your top five, James, I wanted to do a little test to see, one, test your memory, or just to test your kind of, I don't know, matching abilities with films. I'm gonna throw out a film that somebody has suggested, and see if you can match your recommendation from the time. So we've got When Harry Met Sally, and I'll give you a clue with this one. You offered them a triple bill with this. You offered them two films to go along with When Harry Met Sally.
Okay. When Harry Met Sally, it was one of them, It Could Happen to You.
Yes, it was.
Okay, It Could Happen to You. Angels in America? Not Angels in America, sorry. Wings of... What was the...
The Wings of Desire remake, right?
I can only remember the Wim Benders one. Was that the correct choice?
No, it was Moonstruck, and It Could Happen
Moonstruck
to You.
Moonstruck, of course.
So I'll throw out this one, and Blade Runner. What are you pairing with Blade Runner?
Oh yeah, Blade Runner. Was this? I think. Oh yeah, this is my favorite, maybe one of my favorites. Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans.
It is, yeah.
Because yeah, that was again one where if you were trying to find a Nicolas Cage sci-fi film on the level of Blade Runner, you're going to hit, you know, a bit of a dead end. It's not one of his biggest genres, you know. But for something that's got that kind of, you know, jazzy, almost you know, sort of casual vibe, but then ramps up for Times and then all sort of chills. It's got that sort of, you know, interesting rhythm to it. I feel like Bad Lieutenant kind of follows that. It's also just, you know, one bad man, although admittedly one of those two protagonist is worse than the other. One of them is titular Bad Lieutenant. But yeah, that was my connector.
And I'm going to throw out this one because this is actually a friend of the podcast, Claire Ellen Hope, said,
oh, cool,
La La Land for me. And what did you match with La La Land?
Now, this one, I feel like I went, it may have been something stupid, like A Score to Settle, because he plays the piano and sings in that.
No, you actually went for, I'll read out the tweet, which, an LA story about disparate people coming together with a pep in its step. Switch out music for cons, and we'll recommend you Ridley Scott's Matchstick Men, 2003. Yeah. Like, and it's kind of as much as, instead of the singing and dancing, you've got Cage kind of with this rhythmic stutter that he has, and this kind of these ticks, and and I'm sure that Sam Rockwell, like he does in every movie, dances.
Oh, he dances. He definitely does a spin, maybe a point here and there, you know.
Yeah, that's like...
That counts. That's halfway there. For context, for listeners, to vindicate myself, this thread was in April of 2022. And, you know, that just keep that in mind.
This is good stuff. We'll do one more and then we'll get onto your top five. So again, this is another one that I believe you went with might have been a double feature. No, you definitely, it's not a double feature. You went for one over the other. Maybe that will give you a hint to the kind of thinking of this. The Big Lebowski. So a big film for a lot of people. What do you think was your recommendation for this? There's an obvious one.
Yes, I'm pretty sure it was like, you'll think it's Raising Arizona. And part of this was because when I was doing it, I didn't want to re-recommend anything. Like, I wanted that to be almost part of the appeal. And also just to show his range, that you can do this for, you know, 60 movies or however many it is. That, you know, it's probably not 60 movies, but, you know, close to that. So yeah, Raising Arizona, I believe, was the, it could, you know, you'd think it's this one, but the actual one I'm trying to remember, it's like casual hangout, funny. I'm gonna have to ask you for it again. You're just gonna have to read it.
So this one, Raising Arizona was the top choice.
Yeah.
But the kind of one that's the interesting choice is, and you write here, a bearded outsider playing life by his own rules with a penchant for mind-altering substances. Army of One scratches some of that itch, like, which is like,
right,
which is a film that I've managed to find out from doing this podcast and kind of just like poking at people online is. That film came under the kind of the scissors of the Weinsteins, and
I read
that, I think, on like Wikipedia or IMDb. So I reached out to Larry Charles, the film's director, and he said, "Oh yeah, no, there is a cut of that movie that I did that I hope to one day be able to screen to people." And it's
to release the Clark cut.
Yeah, we need the Larry Clark, Larry Charles cut. Not Charles Clark.
Yeah.
Different director. Kids to Army of One would be such a crazy career progression.
That is interesting to hear, because like that one is like a semi, was like, you know, that's one of those films that's on the edge for me in terms of like really liking. I think when you are in the weeds of finishing Nicolas Cage's filmography, you're looking for diamonds in the rough at that point. And the thing with that one, well, there's certainly like, because I actually thought from the outset this was one I was going to hate, that it was going to be the sort of, you know, the epicification of Nicolas Cage, which I find frustrating as someone who just genuinely loves and enjoys him. But there was something to it where there was like a an interesting like empathy for the characters, yeah. which something that, you know, it seems mocking them from the outset, but you can tell, oh no, the film does care about these people, as silly and ridiculous as they are, and some solid jokes are peppered in there. Like,
and you can see the DNA of Larry Charles's previous works. Obviously, he's a guy who did like Borat and like a lot of the stuff, especially when he's supposed to be in Pakistan. It like it looks very kind of Borat-esque. It almost looks kind of like they're just filming Nicolas Cage riding a donkey down a street. It doesn't feel like put on or. There's great talent in that, whether it's like Will Sasso and Paul Scheer playing like his friends in the bar, or is it Wendy Cove? I can't remember the second part, but yeah, the woman who plays like his love interest in it, she's fantastic, and it's like there's so much great talent, and like it's kind of become a mission of mine to raise awareness of the Larry Charles cut, and hopefully one day get to see that and speak to Larry about that kind of. That process.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, I hope he even does, you know, the Paul Schrader thing and just try get it out there, like, dark. Which is, an interesting one. Even if it doesn't, you know, fix the film necessarily, it's fascinating.
It kind of I don't know, heaps on a whole load more of, like, questions.
Oh, yeah, it's like, are you going to break my film? I'm going to break it further until it's just... all about the mindset, like it's an interesting little protest of a piece in some ways.
Yeah, that's one film I've never felt bad about requiring illegally, because it's kind of it was the director himself put it out there, and it was the only way to watch that movie. So let's jump into your top five, and do you have like a criteria in which you've kind of ranked these films, and how wild is that criteria if you have one?
Right, yeah. So this is something that I've been cooking up for a while now, which is just throughout his career. I mean, you'll know this yourself. There are through lines. Some are hyper specific. Some of them are just, you know, feeling, you know, it can be as anything from fake noses to being set in the South/New Orleans, you know, and then also character choice, all this stuff. So yeah, this is something I'm calling the Cage Nexus, right? This is the unifying theory of Nicolas Cage, his approach to acting, where I think that each and every one of his performances involves one or more or all of these sides. So there's Nicolas Cage, the shaman, right? Mm-hmm. This is how he calls what he calls himself, the, you know, his neo-shamanistic acting style, which I think, you know, you could describe this as being like the typical sort of wild man Nicolas Cage performances as you think of them, the one where he is going all out from everything from, you know, Ghost Rider 2 to obviously there's some Mandy and Face Off. There's touches of it everywhere. Then in the opposite side, there's Nicolas Cage, the quiet man. Now we're talking like Pig, Joe, adaptation, mm-hmm. when I feel like there's something to him, the second he sinks his shoulders, he's just in a different mode.
It's like the Adam Sandler doing Punch Drunk Love. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's kind of the going against the grain of what you expect of an actor.
Yeah, and also an actor who's got that there at all times. Like Adam Sandler, it's like he's got that latent anger always, and he can just, like a dial can be turned and it's got a different flavor altogether. Yes. And for Cage, it's like it can be simmering anger, or it can just be a total like peaceful, quiet, shy. It's all there.
Yeah. Well, like, then, with adaptation, the wildness comes through the anxiety and the fear in that character. Whereas like in Face Off, it would be this kind of brash bravado and like almost like simmering hatred for the world and everyone.
And he's so good at that and in so many different ways. The next one is Nicolas Cage, the auteurist, and this is something I love about him, where he will just give himself over to a filmmaker. Like as much as you think of Nicolas Cage and he's associated with his thing, there's also so many times where he does exactly what a filmmaker is known for, like Raising Arizona. He is a Coen Brothers character. Mm-hmm. He's not a Nicolas Cage. He isn't a Coen Brothers character. Like Face Off, he could even say he really gives himself over to John Woo, even though he's definitely doing the shaman stuff, like for the opening for sure. Like, and there's, I think Mandy is another great example of this as well. Then there's Nicolas Cage the supporter, where he can be really good at just balancing things out and really supporting someone else's mm-hmm. performance, which like is, you know, in a lot of his supporting roles, but even in Face Off, he basically hands off the wild Nicolas Cage performance to John Travolta yeah. and then just lets that carry the movie, and he's just, I'll be the solid center,
yeah.
which is totally different to the Rage guy.
That film is testament that like people always think is one of Cage's craziest, and it's like you only get like 15 minutes of that guy. The rest of it is Cage playing it pretty straight as like a nice guy trying to like right wrongs that have been done to him.
Yeah. He just wants his kid back or whatnot. Like, it's very basic stuff. And then the last but not least, and this will lead into the top five, which we'll get through, is Nicolas Cage, the auteur. So this is going from giving himself over to a filmmaker to him being what seems like the almost essential creative force, where there's times where he and his whole persona, his background, just the film would not exist in the same way without him, basically.
Yeah.
And that leads me into my number five pick, which I think is the mixture of Nicolas Cage the Shaman and Nicolas Cage the Auteur, and that is Vampire's Kiss.
Oh, what a pick.
Because that is a film where, you know, we talked about the making of it, he didn't have a full script, there was so much sort of improvising, and I mean, Nicolas Cage's own love for Nosferatu comes through. Like, that film is not the film it is without Nicolas Cage mm-hmm. being the guy. And I think it's just like the best example of him being the auteur of the film he's in. And it's just like hilarious, amazing, inventive. Like, that's not a film where you're going to guess what the next scene is going to be about, because the next scene is him shouting the alphabet. Like,
Well, there's like, there's an aspect to that that I think that was him kind of, and he's called it himself his laboratory, figuring out stuff. And I think like there are stories from the set of that, which like, paint him, and rightfully, I think, in like a bad light. I think he kind of was kind of figuring out his kind of what his acting style was. So I think he did like some outlandish stuff, like request that he had yogurt put on his feet, and I think he was quite mean towards Jessica Bills and stuff like that. And I think like he kind of like that was the one where he got like enveloped in the character. But I think that was because it was a lower budget movie, and it kind of I guess meeting Robert Bierman and not having that full script kind of used it as like this is a chance to play, and like
absolutely
let's mess about with it, let's kind of, and it feels like a lot of the takes in that movie what they call in the industry like a freebie take, like they probably let's get the script and then let's kind of let's try something else. And Cage has gone, I got an idea here, let me try it. Rob Bierman's gone, let's go for it, I guess.
Absolutely. And honestly, I do think it's like an important part of like, because this top five are like personal favorites as well as what I think like really capture what the appeal is for him.
Amazing.
And like that one, I think, starts off something that's throughout his career where there's certain jobs where it feels like he goes for a film because it gives him room to kind of play, essentially. It gives him room to stretch his legs, you know? You think of something like, you know, like Zandali, mm-hmm. like other big actors who, you know, have been in huge movies at that point may not go for Zandali, a Southern gothic drama with, you know, Judge Reinhold, but Cage being like, oh, I can shoot in the South, and also it's like, you know, a steamy drama, and I can kind of go wild with it as a supporting character, like, sure. I feel like you see that throughout of these films where he's just, he can seem interested in just letting, trying things out, practicing almost.
Yeah, and I think up until a certain point, like, you can't see who Cage is, like, who he's going to become, I guess.
Yeah.
Post leaving Las Vegas into his kind of action run, it's kind of then people, I think, had an idea of who they thought Nicolas Cage was. But up until that point, he could have been... he could have been anyone. And a prime example is like a kind of casting what if that gets thrown about a lot. And a lot of people go, oh, I couldn't see that. And I've mentioned this like throughout Cagey this year, is he was rumored to have been the Jeff Daniels role in Dumb and Dumber. And it's like people go, I really can't see that. But it's like, if you look at Cage's career up until that point, it's like, he'd starred in a lot of like rom-coms or out and out comedies, like Trapped in, Trapped in Paradise, It Could Happen to You, Honeymoon in Vegas, like Raising Arizona. Like he kind of had like a similar vibe to Jeff Daniels in that thing of like he could do serious. He could do this kind of worthy stuff. Do you know what I mean? He could do the Cotton Club. He could do like Racing with
even
the
Moon. Time to Birdie. Kill or something like that. I mean, that's his attempt at something sort of more dramatic. But
yeah, but then also he could be this goofball. Do you know what I mean? He could be this real goofball. And like a film I always think that Cage could be in that Jeff Daniels did is Something Wild, the Jonathan Demme movie. It's kind of
I could see that sort of lanky, loose Cage.
Yeah, kind of being thing. This kind of, you could easily see him around that, 1988, doing that kind of like guy who gets, swept away by Melanie Griffith and kind of embroiled. And at the same time, he could easily have done the Ray Liotta role as well. He's one guy who could have done either part of that movie, but it's only in retrospect that we can see that. At the time, it kind of felt like who could he have been?
It did seem like it was a mixture of variety, but it's also looking for identity on screen. I feel like you're right that his on-screen identity did end up becoming really the action role. But I think that is, I do think that's such a big part of his career. That's the supporter role. I feel like so much as he just knows that he can be such a solid base around which,
Because I think,
things can happen.
The three films he would have filmed back to back. And I think A Vampire's Kiss kind of had a bit of release troubles and was delayed a bit. But the three films he would have filmed back to back would have been Raising Arizona, Moonstruck, and Vampire's Kiss, which are kind of all over the place and feel within themselves are a massive sandbox and playing ground for him to figure out who he was going to be, or kind of bringing in all these tools of who he could be in the future. And that I think is one of the most important runs of his career. To kind of give us the Cage we get in the future. It's the Coen brothers have let me loose to basically be a Tex Avery cartoon come to life. It's
that is genuinely, because that's something I feel like has really stuck with him, because you see it on his cameo and Never on a Tuesday, where the story is that he could do whatever he wanted, so Nicolas Cage chooses to wear a fake nose and talk in a funny voice. And so there's clearly is a part of him that just likes that silliness. I mean, it's the same way that he loves Superman, he loves some elemental base sort of storytelling things. And I mean, Nosferatu as well, he definitely seems to the very, basic sort of nature of storytelling and acting, getting across sort of emotion and drama through these very elemental, stories.
Well, it feels perfect that we're talking about Vampire's Kiss now as well, because we've just recently had the Renfield trailer, which feels like it was all roads lead to this, right? It's kind of like Vampire's Kiss was the kind of calling card of one day, please let me play Dracula. And you can imagine Cage when he got offered that role being I've been waiting my whole career. I kind of got a taste of it with Peter Lowe, but now I get to play the man himself. I will revel in this.
I hope that was just a delay for, I mean, when you hear him say I am Dracula in the trailer, he is just, I mean, he is chewing the scenery so much. He is having a three-course meal. He is loving it. He is swimming in the river of ham. He is just cooking a roast gammon for everyone at work, and they're all loving it. He's dealing it out.
Well, and you can imagine from seeing Chris McKay's he did a post recently on his social media platforms about what was the kind of visual aesthetics for and you can imagine the conversations him and Cage would have been having about their Dracula. So they've got London After Midnight is in there, The Man Who Laughed, and Christopher Lee as Dracula, were the kind of
perfect.
And you can imagine they would have definitely talked about Nosferatu, and I guess there would have been a hesitation for Cage being do you know what, I kind of aped Nosferatu in Vampire's Kiss. So let's draw upon some of these other images. So like The Man Who Laughed is a film I haven't seen, but like from seeing Cage's aesthetic in Renfield, I'm like, oh, the teeth are 100% The Man Who Laughed.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, that film has, I mean, he's talked a lot, and I mean, he talks about it a lot in The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, his love of German expressionism. Mm-hmm. And so like Man Who Laughs fits perfectly in there. And I mean, it definitely is. It's this, because the main character in The Man Who Laughs is this guy who's got this stuck rictus grin, and you know, he's crying through the smile of it, and you can see he's, you know, Cage is almost trying to bring a sort of, I don't know, inhuman mouth movement. Almost seems like it would be painful, but he loves it, you know. Yeah, he's delighting in it. I'm looking forward to that.
Perfect. So what have we got for number four?
Right, number four, this is Nicolas Cage in a perfect slash role. He's the shaman slash supporter. It's Face Off. It's John Woo's 1997 classic. I mean, you could argue this is also Nicolas Cage, the auteurist, as well, because he is giving himself over to John Woo. He is walking past doves. He is jumping in slow motion. He is spinning. He is doing all that good stuff. I mean, the thing I always point to is the first like 15 minutes of Face Off. That action sequence is better than what closes most other action films, like that whole airport sequence, and Nicolas Cage turning in one of his funniest, most like just demonically evil, but like an impish spirit of just mad sickness. Like, he's just a terrorist for hire, which is just a wild concept on its own. That guy is just like, yeah, I love just doing evil. He nails it, he sells it.
There's like, and that is a film, because I had the good fortune of speaking to the writers of that film, so Mike Werb and Michael Caleri, last year. Celebrate the 25th anniversary. And they said, like, what a nice guy he was with that film. Because I think, like, the studio wanted to change the name to Doppelgangers. And they were like, obviously, as writers were like, well, this movie isn't about doppelgangers. It's about people switching faces. The script is called Face Off. And Nicolas Cage kind of turned to them and said, we're going to shoot something today. Don't worry. I'm gonna make sure that this movie is called Face Off, and then delivered that speech that he delivers to Nick Cassavetes with the "I want to take his face off," and that was like the moment that they went,
"That's beautiful."
I think this movie's called Face Off, and it's like Cage was like, "Let's do these guys a solid." Do you know what I mean? Like you were saying, not only is he kind of like the supporter to the director, just being that supporter to the screenwriters as well. It's their vision, it's their story, and having that support for them to be like, hey, like, even down something like as trivial as a title, like, do you know what I mean? Like not that,
yeah.
But obviously, a title, I say trivial, but like, is massively important sometimes. Like, but like,
totally is, it absolutely is. There's a Face Off is, it just hits something in the brain, mm-hmm. which Doppelgangers just, it wouldn't quite. And I mean, yeah, that's a perfect example, and that's a great story. I didn't know that. And yeah, like, it's the thing where I feel like, since he is so often seen as an almost overriding personality, and it's so fascinating that when you actually look at his career, so often it's about like serving whatever the greater vision is. And like, you know, all films is about everyone contributing, and everyone can be like their author and their own side of the production. Like, you know, we're talking in very general terms, but something like Face Off is so, it's got that operatic, like perfect sort of perfectly pitched melodrama of John Woo's Hong Kong titles, that I feel like Face Off is probably the best English language representation of that. And like Cage and Travolta, to be fair, understanding how to play it for America.
Yeah.
Stream.
Yeah, it's like there's just like a quality about that film that is just, I don't know, like mesmeric. And like every time I watch it, like you pick out something like new and interesting. Yeah. I think like Cage, we kind of mentioned it earlier, like when you were going through like the kind of criteria that you have, is that is one where Cage does his bit at the beginning and then is very much supporting Travolta to do that, like for the rest of the movie. I mean, apart from the moments when he's aping what Caster Troy would be doing, as he's like the,
which in itself is a great performance on its own. Like it shows it's the vulnerable side of Cage that's always been there, and he really just, I know, like John Woo. I mean, it's such a smart choice to have Cage be playing that part, just because that opening performance sticks with you so much that when the faces swap, you buy it. You know what that character is like, because, I mean, when you think of how much time you actually spent with him, it's kind of amazing. You spent more time with the John Travolta version, but you always remember the real Caster Troy. And that's just so smart.
Well, if you've got a line in your script that says, I could eat a peach for hours, you're going to have the skinny on who that guy is.
Oh, yeah. you don't forget.
Oh. Yeah, you're going to be like, he's not a good guy. Like,
he's a bad seed. He's a bad dude. We're not pro Caster Troy. We think he's cool, but he's a bad guy.
Yeah, so we would love to play around with those guns and kind of twirl them and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I'd love to walk onto a runway in a nice leather jacket.
and spin, have it bellow in the wind. You would feel like he feels. You'd feel on top of the world. And that film is just such a great jump back to, I mean, that's almost the pinnacle of practical action cinema, of these, you know, Hong Kong style, getting given the budget of Hollywood, although for better and for worse, not having the danger of Hong Kong cinema. Just the tactility of people are firing bullets. This room is being shattered by a billion bits of debris, and that's just a joy to watch.
Yeah, and like just his interplay with like Travolta in that as well. Yeah. Like those kind of moments where they do speak to each other, or there's that iconic moment where they're kind of either side of the wall and stuff like that. It's just
beautiful.
It's just like,
we're jumping over each other. But yeah, like Hong Kong cinema has that connection to, like, I feel Tamil and Bollywood cinema, where it has the, I don't know, to use the line from a Nicolas Cage director, Werner Herzog, I feel like they reach towards that ecstatic truth where it's so exaggerated and bombastic, but those emotions are so dead on, and the actors give themselves to it so much that, yeah, it feels real, regardless of how wild and bombastic it all gets. It's great, and I want more of that. I mean, imagining Nicolas Cage in a RRR style movie
that would be perfect. The one genre we're waiting for Cage to be in, let's be honest, is a musical. Waiting for him to be in a musical. That's what we're waiting for.
Absolutely, we get tiny hints, and it's not enough.
James, let's get to your number three pick.
Right, this is the ultimate sort of auteurist Cage film, and it's Raising Arizona. Mm-hmm. This is the film where I feel Cage gives himself up to another filmmaker the most. Well, there is still, he's an actor. You can always see Cage-isms. Touches of him. Yeah, of course. It's infectious, but I feel like the Coen's tone, I mean, even just the language that, you know, their characters use is so specific. I mean, when you read like the script for The Big Lebowski, the film is, you know, near enough line for line. It doesn't look like there's tons of room for, you know, improv there. And it's such a controlled performance, even though his character's, you know, so loose and manic. I mean, he's clearly going for, I mean, we talked about his love for German Expressionism, but that whole era, you can see his love for it. And there he's doing, you know, Buster Keaton, with Harold Lloyd in there, the kind of, you know, he's trying his best, but he's a scrappy guy. He's Bugs Bunny. Gives himself over to it.
I find it really interesting of like the directors as well that Cage has managed to like pick off throughout his career. Like, especially when we look back at kind of who are either like from the new Hollywood generation or the guys who have kind of come after them, who Cage has worked with, he's kind of picked off like some really great names, like including the Coen brothers, and he kind of got in there quite early. What, this is their second film? third film?
I believe it's second. I think it's, which is kind of incredible just how fast they dialed into exactly who they were. But I mean, that's why I think, like, when I was really just thinking about the things I appreciate about them and this whole sort of idea, you know, quote-unquote unified theory, is that he's someone who can be so dominating of a film, but then also can give himself over to these fantastic, like, directors, writers, creators. Like, you know, his Scorsese film, Bringing Out the Dead, he's doing the performance that that film needs, not the film performance that he just fancies doing or playing around with. You know, he's in it for the film, and I feel like Raising Arizona is one of the best examples of that.
Was having reverence and kind of, yeah, having that, like, reverence to the script and the people. And, like, that's the thing with, you could imagine with Bring Out the Dead, like, what we're talking, like, 30 years into a career with Scorsese and Schrader. So, like, there's going to be that reverence to those guys. But to have that reverence to the Coen brothers, who, yeah, as we said, are, like, kind of fresh out the gate, really. Do you know what I mean? Like, he might have seen...
Oh, absolutely.
He would have definitely probably seen Blood Simple either in the prep for this movie. But, like, to have that reverence to them and be like, I'm going to give myself over to you is an absolute, like... testament to, like, what an actor he is and can be. And I know that there's, like, speculation and kind of chatter that him and the Coens didn't get on that well, and I guess that's why we never saw Cage in another Coen brothers film, because they're famed for kind of working with people again and again and again.
Absolutely. I mean, like, maybe it's one of those cases where you know, I'm giving him a lot of credit for giving himself over to a filmmaker, but maybe there was a lot of, you know, controlling had to go on to make that happen, to make that great performance happen. Because, like, sometimes, you know, there are these very, you know, controlled or controlling directors who sometimes don't quite gel with other actors. Like, there's a story about David Lynch and the filming of Twin Peaks Season 3. With Tom Sizemore. Mm-hmm. And Tom Sizemore is great in that series. And just... David Lynch in this story is how I imagine the Coens might be, where just in one random little line, Tom Sizemore, you know, he riffs a little, he changes the lineup, and over, like, the bullhorn, David Lynch just says in his, like, great voice, which I cannot do, he's like, Tom, are we gonna have to put you to the back of the class? And just, like, he's just gets, okay, he just wants me to say the words, let's go on with it. I feel like the Coens could be like that, just they want their thing done, and maybe dealing with somebody who's real loose and at that point fresh. I mean, he's swinging for stuff, and I mean, like, in Moonstruck, as you say, so close around that time, early in his career, he's with a sort of veteran director and writer, and he's swinging for the fences. Mm-hmm. He is up against with Cher, a megastar, and he's like, I want to be as big on this screen. Like, that's going to be hard to reel in.
And I think what a lot of people forget is Cage was 23 when he made the like Moonstruck and Raising Arizona. Yeah. He was young. He was really fucking young. And to kind of deliver such a kind of self-assured and kind of, like, do you know what I mean? He knows what, like... And yeah, testament of that probably would come to the Coen brothers as well. And you'd imagine the discussions they would have had of, like, Cage probably bringing stuff to the table and them kind of saying, this is what we're going for, and them kind of getting it. It's like, 23 is young, like, especially, like, in an actor's career. Like, that's...
I know, yeah, absolutely. And especially for the range of things he was doing at that time, he's figuring things out. And at the same time, you see exactly the actor he's always going to be, like, because I feel like he's young, but he's got that sadness to him already that he wears in his Quiet Man performances, I think. Like, I mean, that's Moonstruck, obviously, is, you know, like, oh, I lost my hand! You know, he's tragic. He's got an inherent tragedy to him, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, this plays into that thing of, like, great comedy chops as well. Like,
oh, yeah.
Like, and I always say it about, and I imagine this isn't going to be your number two or number one pick, but, like, Trapped in Paradise, even though he's against two SNL alumni, is the funniest, like, part of that trio.
Yeah.
Because, like, he's, like, a great straight man and kind of gets the humor in it, whereas he's not John Lovitz going, I'm John Lovitz and I'm going to be all like this. Or he's not Dana Carvey going,
Oh, yeah. Dana Carvey may just go, he may have just like goosed it a little too much in that one. I feel like Cage knew the level and Carvey slipped in the ice a little. But yeah, you're right. This is a perfect example of Cage as the supporter. He knows he can't go too big, too much, because otherwise this is just noise. Like, which kind of leads me into a film that has a lot of noise in it. My number two pick, I would say it's this. My number one choice is what I would say is the center of the Nicolas Cage Nexus. It encompasses everything. Amazing. This one encompasses almost everything, and that is Panos Cosmatos's Mandy. Because it has Nicolas Cage giving himself over to a filmmaker. I mean, a stylist, someone who has a very deliberate pace, aesthetic approach to filmmaking. And Nicolas Cage, he's worked with hundreds of millions of dollars. He's working smaller scale. He's going quiet. He's allowing himself to build. He's starting from a place of love, really, in the film, more than anything. And then, of course, it builds to one of the ultimate Nicolas Cage, sort of the shaman performance of just, he is excited. He's a man, especially at that point in his life, who, you know, publicly has gone through so many marriages and ups and downs in his career. And that film is just a sort of primal scream of rage and loss, and just wanting to feel like you've got some control of things. And I feel like it's just, he pours that into it. You know, he's got moments that will be hilarious, moments that will be creepy, and then moments that will be genuinely moving. And I think that is one of my favorite things about him, is just that free-flowing nature. He's rarely, if ever, one note.
Yeah, because something we talk about on the podcast quite a lot, and kind of a stock question when talking about specific films, is like, does Cage freak out? And with Mandy, I've always said it's an earned freak out. Like, when you get that kind of pivotal moment in that film where he, like, does that amazing performance in the bathroom, it's like, of course that is how that act of how that person is reacting to what they've just been through. It's like, and what I love about that scene as well is, there's a fuck up within that scene. You see a moment where the camera kind of like moves in on the track, and I think Cage had thrown, Cage had thrown a towel down, and it kind of landed on the track, and the camera kind of goes in, pulls out for a second, and I guess like a runner has just pulled that towel off, and then goes in again, like on the track.
Wow.
But like, to the kind of layman, and like, do you know what I mean? Like, unless you know that story and you're like really digging into, like, do you know what I mean? Watching the film on a granular kind of, how is this put together level? You don't pick up on it because you're so swept away in the emotion of that scene. And I don't think that film works. Like, a lot of people feel like that film should be like, the criticism towards it, like, oh, this needs to be an 18 minutes nuts and bolts revenger. And it's like, well, I don't think that moment necessarily works without that kind of hours worth of build up and that slow burning tension, and that kind of Cage getting to run the gamut of who he is, and the love that him and Andrea Riseborough's character Mandy have for each other. Like, if you don't get to know Red and Mandy and the goofball that he can be, do you know what I mean? When he kind of does that like crap joke about chips, do you know what I mean? Stuff like that.
Yeah, like, yeah, you're absolutely right. Because the thing is that, I don't know, I think that film is such a mood piece, which is also something Cage hadn't really been able to play around in until that point, of being a part of a feeling, you know. And as you say, the build-up is so key to it, because the build-up is him being a quiet, content man. It's kind of the opposite of what we often see Cage as somebody who's either, you know, anxious and all things like adaptation and whatnot, or he's on the run, or he's desperate, or he is angry, he's scared, all these things. There's somebody who's happy and is like exactly where they want to be, and it's just to build up the quiet feeling of when you can just sit and be happy with someone. You know, there's a very I don't know, gentle nature to it, which allows that building chaos and just hell that he's going to get to emotionally actually land. Love that film.
Again, I feel like I'm really just like dropping names of people I've spoken to, but this is relevant. I spoke to Brett Buckman, who edited Mandy, and he told me that Panos Cosmatos, as they were editing like scenes, he would kind of stand there with his vape, kind of plume out some smoke, and just go slower. Like he kind of like he wanted to languish, and almost wanted the audience to languish in the feelings of the scenes and stuff like that. And I know that Panos Cosmatos has been quoted as saying his first film, Beyond the Black Rainbow, is kind of like an inhale of grief, and Mandy, it's like this exhale of grief. And I always find that like a beautiful kind of way of talking about that film. It's like, it is that kind of, I don't know, almost like fantasy of what you have of like the emotions when you're grieving someone. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I can't put it to a thing of like, I haven't lost someone so close to me like that. But a thing I can kind of relate it to is that feeling of like losing a loved one, as in like splitting up with someone. And like, that almost feels like you almost go through this weird, like 7 stages of grief in that, and you kind of feel that, and it really taps into the anger that you feel through that, and like, do you know what I mean? You want to get to a point and you want to
and it turns it into something like cosmic as well. And in some ways I feel like Mandy would be a good double feature with Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life, because that is a film where, you know, the much talked about universe sequence, another film people might wish was shorter, but the creation of the world sequence, you know, Jessica Chastain's character, like, you know, is praying and, you know, says like, you know, when my son died, where were you? And then we cut to literally the birth of the universe and just like the expansion of everything and the creation of the world, yada, yada. And I feel like Mandy similarly is trying to get to some sort of like cosmic place where when you suffer loss, you can't wrap your head around it. It's so unfair and hateful that it may as well be, you know, demon bikers that use wasp drugs, because that makes as much sense as somebody you love just being taken from you, you know. And I feel like that film, there's something very beautiful about that. And I feel like Cage really wears the weight of that, as it gets, you know, wild at times, obviously. I guess, you know, yeah, 10-foot chainsaw or whatever, but then because of the slowness, because of the importance drawn to everything, you could see that as some sort of, you know, symbolic totem of just like him wielding his rage, you know, like that's the point you're at in that movie.
I'm convinced as well that like Cage's aesthetic and the kind of chainsaw moment is a reference to draw it back to Angus Scrimm, is a reference to Phantasm 2 and like Reggie Bannister's like kind of aesthetic, when he kind of has the utility vest and there's a chainsaw moment in that. I'm like, that feels like the kind of movie that Panos Cosmatos would have seen and been like, you know what, we're gonna get Cage in a utility kind of outfit, like drenched in blood and like having a chainsaw duel with someone. Like, it's a
that's like the really cool thing about that movie, is that while it can be, you know, emotional and all these great themes and aesthetic qualities, it's also like the equivalent of having the first film and a sequel film to any horror franchise together. It's like, you know, it's got Evil Dead of being like slightly slower, scrappier and genuinely scary, and then it's also got Evil Dead 2 quality of like, ah, we're also getting like real bloody and doing some wacky stuff. And as you say, it's got Phantasm 1 of like, oh, cosmic spookiness, and also, hey, you know, the ice cream man's gonna fight demons.
And there's like, there's some great line deliveries from Cage in that movie. Like, one that always sticks in my head is when he says to one of the kind of Cenobite bikers, like, you ripped my shirt! And like that animation sequence in that, when he kind of takes the like demon cocaine or like LSD and like kind of,
yeah, it's beautiful. It's,
yeah, and that
incorporates so much of what the film's aesthetic is already drawing from and becomes it again in a new way.
Yeah, that's like, that is a film that every time I watch it, I like it even more. And yeah. I think a little tease for the listeners. I think James, I've got one or two t-shirts, probably two t-shirts dropping soon. That I think you're going to be a big fan of. Let's just say that.
The tease is out.
So let's, with that tease hanging in the air, let's get on to your number one pick.
Yeah, number one pick. This is at the center of my Nicolas Cage nexus. You know, this bright star that encompasses, I feel, every aspect of him as a performer, and also just in a very base level, I think it's a fantastic film from a filmmaker I'm a huge fan of. It's The Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans by Werner Herzog, 2009. And, apologies. That film, it has Nicolas Cage, he gives himself to a filmmaker. It's also a film that, with any other actor, would not have the same rhythms to it. You know, you would not be lurching from a quiet scene of a sad, addicted man talking to the woman he has this like one tenuous connection with, to a man wearing the world's largest revolver so high up his trousers, like it looks like a carrot top prop, and he's like hiding behind the door like Nosferatu. Like, the film vacillates through Cage, and at the same time, like, it's a film that it works in so many levels for me, because the first time I was just so bowled over by how, you know, oh, it's Nicolas Cage going like real crazy and so many wild things happening, you know, like Shoot Him Again, his soul is still dancing, like that's beautiful and hilarious. But it really is as well one of the great sort of like post-Katrina films for one, but also ones just about generally systems of power in times of crisis, because like there's so many animals in that film, you know, there's alligators getting knocked over in the highway, and there's iguanas and tables that might not exist. Like, post-Katrina, Werner Herzog depicts that landscape as one where the systems has allowed this to happen, and they've allowed just all the worst things to rise to the surface and to proliferate and to grow. And the ultimate joke of that film is just Nicolas Cage being as comically evil and just like terrible as someone can be, and failing upward is the ultimate story that I feel like we see a lot with, like, even in life, in terms of, you know, people in control you know, people who, oh, this person who's been in the force for so long, it turns out, well, all these horrible things have been happening over those years. And it's certainly within the context of America and the war on drugs as just being this thing of, I know, so much evil goes into the enforcing of something, and yet you are enforcing what the law is at the end of the day by these all these evil things you've done. So well done, my friend. It's got Werner Herzog's loose, beautiful sort of improvisational sort of energy to sort of camera work and everything. And yeah, it's always a film that stuck with me. And for him as a performer, I just think he does everything in that film. I think he does everything that he loves to do and does so well.
Had you been a fan, or had you ever seen the Abel Ferrara 1993 film? Because I personally feel that this film kind of uses that, but then makes it something completely different. As you said, it kind of draws in, like, it makes it about the time that it's set. It kind of uses the almost an archetypal character, but then it's almost like, I don't know, it's like a quasi-sequel to that movie, do you know what I mean, opposed to a remake.
The connection there is always so weird, because Herzog's always very just like, no, there was no connection, I just thought it was a good title. And it's just like, that's a very specific, just thought it was a good title. But also, regardless, like, yeah, like, Bad Lieutenant, the original, is the 70s decrepit New York, like, Catholic guilt. Like, he is, like, abominable, but he's also, like, he's almost, like, an abominable aberration in his own way. Whereas I feel like what Werner Herzog does in shifting it forward is that the big sort of twist by the end of the day almost is that the aberration is the norm. You're almost watching the whole movie almost as if you're watching, you know, Uncut Gems of how can he keep getting away with this? Yeah. When is this gonna, you know, come and catch him up? When is, you know, Val Kilmer gonna, you know, like rat him in, or the worst thing gonna happen? And no, like, none of it matters.
Yeah.
There's a weird sort of almost like nihilism to it, and that certainly carries over emotionally to Cage's character of like beating the addiction, but, you know, not really. He's still thinking about, do fish have dreams? Like,
yeah, this is one that like is due a rewatch for me, like, because like it's kind of like, I don't know. I think when I've watched it before, I'm like, this is quite heavy. Like, do you know what I mean? I've got to pass out my like viewings of this. I can't just kind of like mainline Bad Lieutenant, Port Called New Orleans. And like, I've got a massive soft spot, and I don't know why, it's kind of become a staple between my friends of the Abel Ferrara version. There's something about Harvey Keitel's performance in that. And like, as I said, Cage just like different, and both of them have like, they share a scene which is absolutely horrific in my eyes, which is when like when he stops when he stops the couple kind of canoodling in a car, or yeah. He stops someone in a car. And I think
in the Werner Herzog one, it's like them walking to their car from a club or something like that. But
and in the Abel Ferrara one, it's like Harvey Keitel kind of, I don't know, stopping people in a car and like masturbating, and it is just like, yeah, it's like that. And that, I think in both films that comes quite early on, that's kind of like the benchmark of this is how bad this lieutenant is.
Yeah, he is. It lives up to its title. You can never deny that he is a bad lieutenant. He is not a good lieutenant, and his port of call is indeed New Orleans. Truth all the way down. And yeah, like, it's very, like, some people would maybe say something like could be excessive, and I think the film is, the excessiveness exists in two planes of absurdity to the point of humor, because I mean, Herzog has always had like humor throughout his career, like from Geary onwards. Like, he's just, I don't know, you can just see he gets interested in things, throws in, you know, a talking decapitated head because, you know, it's funny. And Bad Lieutenant, though, it also exists on the line of, yeah, being dark and heavy. And I mean, I think the fact that the landscape of New Orleans, what that brings to it is this true just weight, is just, you feel it, like, is ludicrous as things get. And yeah, I think starting so early with just the putrid behavior, like, as you were talking about, I think is just so core, because both films are just straight off the bat, right, here are enforcers of, you know, systems and what they dictate as morality. They are disgusting. That's where we're starting from. The people who enforce everything are terrible. Mm-hmm. Let's go.
Yeah, and I think it's a film that kind of, it's probably unfortunately aged well, because like we're kind of seeing these kind of people. Do you know what I mean? We're kind of seeing that this behavior is prevalent within the kind of people who we have to enforce the law. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, both are just like ultimately a very basic thing of just saying like, these people are people too.
Yes.
Ultimately, the idea that they are some sort of paragon of anything is crazy, because there's bad people everywhere, and when you give bad people guns, what are they gonna do with that? Like, that's just like the ultimate thing. And I feel like, especially as Herzog being an outsider, like, because I think the Ferrara film, being from such a person who knows that world innately, it has its own lived in quality. And then Herzog on the other side is the outsider looking in. And to him, I think that's where the absurdity comes from. That just image of Nicolas Cage's ludicrously big revolver sticking out of his trousers right before he pulls out an old woman's like breathing apparatus. Like, it's just almost, he sees it as patently absurd you'd ever give people guns. Because do you know what people do behind closed doors?
Yeah.
Do you know what this guy's doing all the time? Why would you ever give him a gun?
Yeah. Because he can pass a test. Do you know what I mean? Like, in a rig system that, like, it's just crying out for like crying out for people who are kind of like got a couple of screws loose to like decide, like, do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, you know, yeah. It kind of points out the whole kind of absurdity of people who would choose to do this job in the first place.
Yeah, and it's also a fantastic riff on the sort of Clint Eastwood Dirty Harry type, another long revolver using guy of just like, he gets the job done, and it's just, I mean, Bad Lieutenant's the ultimate, like, but at what cost? Yes. Like, what job is he getting done? Like,
yeah,
by just destroying on the way
to himself and to others. More importantly, do you know what I mean? It's like, who kind of comes out as a victim in this? It's just bananas. Well, yeah, that's a solid top five, man. Like, that's
five.
I absolutely love that. So, is there any kind of films that didn't quite make your top five?
I mean, I feel like there is films I definitely thought, like, they're just so, I feel like, important to him as an actor. And I feel like if you have any interest in them and him, they're sort of like key pieces. And one of them I mentioned before, and that is Zandali. It's weirdly one that, like, I always just think of and come back to, just like him and, you know, Judge Reinhold, like, slow waltzing on a dock. Like, I'm not saying it's his best film or even amongst his top anything, but I feel like there's something about it, both his choices and even the choice to be in that movie, that says something about his psychology. What it says, you know, that's going to take smarter men than me, but it says something.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, was it Cage just going, erotic thrillers are big at the moment, let's kind of jump on that wave? Or was it like,
it's erotic thrillers with Mark Twain or sort of Glass Menagerie? Yeah, just like, I feel like that's what he saw, was Glass Menagerie, but with Basic Instinct and a crime movie.
There's chance for me to cover myself in paint in this movie. And, do some things with butter, I believe, is something he talks about.
Yeah, I think he sticks his hand in some places in that movie. he gets mucky. That's, and yet another one I think has come up. I want to think of at least one that would not be mentioned. So I'll say this instead, is Dog Eat Dog, the Schrader film. Because, like, he's clearly got a love for Schrader from, like, Bringing Out the Dead onward, and just loves working with him. Dog Eat Dog is just a great example of, like, Nicolas Cage not being the craziest performance in the movie. Like, he's totally supporting Willem Dafoe's Mad Dog.
Yeah.
And just, it's almost, you could see the film as a great joke if you sort of followed up something like Vampire's Kiss with Dog Eat Dog, because you could just imagine that Dog Eat Dog is Nicolas Cage looking at his characters in other films and being like, you're a bit much, mate. Like, just, you're gonna get us all killed. Like, just transplanting that into any situation where you can get any trouble is a nightmare. And then how the film shifts into a weird character study of Nicolas Cage's own Humphrey Bogart-esque persona, which becomes increasingly explicit. I think that one's got an insight into him as well.
Well, I think that film makes a great double bill with Wild at Heart as well, because both of them, they share in common, it's like, oh, Cage is, like if you just look at it without, like, seeing the cast list, you're like, oh, Cage is going to be the craziest guy in this movie. And it's like, Willem Dafoe, the only other guy to kind of match him and, like, be like, hold my beer. Like, you know,
yeah,
like,
they're a great tag team. You know, you get them in the ring, they are just hopping back and forth.
I'm waiting to see a movie. Like, I really want to see a movie where it's like those two are kind of like co-leads, like, apart from Doggy. Do you know what I mean? Where they're kind of like, I don't know, like, and I think. Like, Willem Dafoe gets brought up so much on this podcast with the fact that he's the only other person I can think about that kind of has a similar career to Cage in that way of, like, can kind of do stuff that's in the mainstream, can kind of flirt between the thing, can do these weird stuff, can do, like, whereas Cage, like, does the straight to VOD stuff or, like, the lower budget stuff. It's like Willem Dafoe goes off and makes, like, these weird art house experimental movies. Like,
speaking of Ferrara,
Abel Ferrara's guy, he's doing Tommaso, he's doing Eternity's Gate, or he's doing all these weird, like, I know Eternity's Gate's not a Ferrara movie, but he's doing like Serbia, for instance, like a movie I saw at like London Film Festival, was like, what the fuck was that? Like, and yeah, it's like that those two are like the kind of, I don't know, the two guys that I think in years to come people look back on and go, what fucking careers those two had.
they're magnetic, and I think they're people who they walk that beautiful line of being able to be great naturalists, you know, like Willem Dafoe can do Florida Project perfectly, but both of them have an innate askewness. Like, I mean, there's a basic thing, they just have great faces. Yeah, great faces to look at.
They look weird. Like, and I mean that in the best perfectly. Sense. Like, they don't look like your kind of archetypal Hollywood handsome man. Like, they've got a unique quality. They look unique. Do you know what I mean?
They've lived a life. Yes. You believe it. And I think Willem Dafoe, similarly to Nicolas Cage, can have that thing where he gives himself to filmmakers more than Cage does. I feel like Willem Dafoe is so good at just, I want to, you know, be fueled by your creative energy and do what's right for that and do my own thing in there. But yeah, definitely just got that very bombastic quality that always somehow fits, regardless of the sort of level other people are playing on. They can go bigger and keep things in the right level.
Like, Willem Dafoe's got a movie I think it's premiering at Berlin Film Festival called Inside, which if you haven't seen the trailer, like, is absolutely nuts. It's like he was like, oh, so you like The Lighthouse, where it was me and Robin Pattinson. It's like, how about a movie where it's me locked inside of a luxury apartment, losing my fucking mind for 90 minutes to 2 hours? And it's like, as soon as I saw that, I was like, sign me the fuck up. And I was like, when are we going to get Cage doing something similar? Do you know what I mean? When are we going to get a film that is just like Cage alone? Do you know what I mean? Like, kind of like a character study of a guy just losing his mind. Because I think, Willem Dafoe, Cage are the only two guys who can really do that and sell it to an audience.
Oh yeah. And I mean, I feel like I feel like that's Willem Dafoe testing every person who's ever tweeted sort of like, man, I could just watch Willem Dafoe do his thing all through a movie. And he's just like, okay, I'll give it to him because we've all thought it. And yeah, Nicolas Cage, I mean, I'd love to see, you know, his, you know, Secret Honor or whatever, just doing his great monologue film. I feel like he's got it in him. What it would be, who knows? Maybe you'd need to be playing Max Schreck or something like that.
That's that. What you said about Max Schreck, there's a connection with Willem Dafoe, because Nicolas Cage, one of the rare films that he's produced that he doesn't star in is Shadow of the Vampire, which obviously Willem Dafoe plays Nosferatu.
That's a beautiful thing to just be like, you did get the idea that he just wanted to see that movie.
Of course. Well, James, thank you so much for this top five. This has been an absolutely fantastic chat, and thank you so much for coming and getting caged in with me.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm glad to have been caged in. I'm looking forward to being uncaged, but it's been great being caged in for now. And Cage is still going, and I am dedicated to continuing watching all his films as they keep happening. Thank you very much.
Where can people keep up to date with everything that's going on with the Glasgow Film Festival and like what the program will be this year?
These are the big dates and the big things you need to know. I mean, we're announcing our program really soon, pretty much. It depends when this releases, but it's going to be on the 25th of January when our program's announced. And then the festival itself runs from the 1st to the 12th of March 2023. And that's in the GFT, Glasgow Film Theatre in Glasgow. And I've seen the program. I can't say anything about it, which is great. Being recorded and having to wear that weight is wonderful. But the good thing is that I can just say that it's a really great program. I'm really looking forward to seeing more of these films. And amazing. I mean, my thing is kind of easy in terms of the Glasgow Film Festival job. I tweet about the stuff they do, and I promote it, and like, as long as they program good things, it makes my job pretty easy. So like, I'm feeling pretty cozy for the festival ahead, to be honest.
Amazing. Well, guys, you don't have to wait long. All you have to do is wait until tomorrow to see what the program is. Well, yeah, again, James, thank you so much for coming and getting caged in with me.
Thank you very much. And yeah, have great rest of your cageuary. And yeah, look forward to the year of Cage ahead. He's got some big ones coming.
That he does. What is in the pipeline is very, very exciting.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Podcharles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Droop Town Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.